Hi, this is Scott Wilkinson, host of Home Theater Geeks. In episode 108, I chat with sound editor Lon Bender about his stellar career and the process of creating sound for movies. So stay tuned.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Home Theater Geeks is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com.
This is Home Theater Geeks with Scott Wilkinson, recorded April 23rd, 2012. Episode 108, The Sound of Movies. This episode of Home Theater Geeks is brought to you by Netflix. Watch thousands of TV episodes and movies on your PC, Mac, iPad, iPhone, or TV instantly. All stream directly to you, saving you time, money, and hassle. For your free 30-day trial, go to netflix.com/twit. Hey there, Scott Wilkinson here, online editor of hometheater.com. This week's guest geek is Lon Bender, a sound editor of over 60 movies, including The Hunger Games, most recently. And I believe, Lon, you've actually won an Academy Award, haven't you?
I have, Scott. I won I've actually won two Academy Awards. One was a creative award for the film Braveheart, and I also won a scientific award because, you know, the Academy is the Motion Picture Arts and Sciences, and I actually came up with a schema to put roll, scene, and take information on 35-millimeter work tracks when you needed them to come up with edit decision lists in order to use a digital editing system. So that was at the beginning of the transition from film to digital editing back in the late 80s.
Wow. So you've been involved in this for quite some time, haven't you?
I have. I started our company back in 1982, which was a couple of years after I actually started editing when I was first out of high school. So it was a long, long time ago, but it's been a great run for sure.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Well, thanks so much for being on the show, especially after NAB. You've just come back from NAB as well, where you gave a couple of presentations.
I have, yeah. We gave two different presentations that last Tuesday. One was an hour-long presentation for The Hunger Games, and we had a full house and a lot of people very interested in digging in deeply into the way that the sessions were made up and how we laid out things and sort of created some specific things in the world for that. And then recently I was honored with an Academy Award nomination for the film Drive, and there was a smaller, sort of intimate kind of setting where we had a thing called the post pit, and we discussed the use of Driver's car engine and how it reflected his state of mind and the story beats as it went along. So two very interesting panels, and both of them were very well received. People seem interested in sound these days.
Yes. Well, as I've said many times, and a lot of people that I talk to also say, people tend to spend a lot of time thinking about the picture, but the sound is at least 50% of the movie-going experience.
It really is 50% of the experience because it takes pictures and brings them to life. It turns them into three-dimensional experiences for the audience. And, you know, I started young. I'm still young, but I've been doing this for almost 35 years. And there's still a great experience and wonderful sense of putting sounds together with picture, whether it's a big spaceship or a cavalry of horses, or if it's even just a splash of a tire on a lonely street on a lonely night scene. It's just an amazing experience putting sounds to picture and having them leap off the screen at you and create a whole three-dimensional world. It's fantastic.
Even when the movie itself isn't in 3D.
Even when it's not in 3D.
Hey, listen, before we go on, I want to make sure that that everyone knows, those of you who are watching live at live.twit.tv or in the chat room at irc.twit.tv, can post questions for Lon, and I'll pass along as many as I can. So I wanted to ask you, Lon, take us through the basic process you go through in a movie. What exactly does a sound editor do to put those sounds with the picture to create an entire movie experience?
Well, the process has changed in some ways very much due to technology, but in some ways very little due to the way that the projects take shape and the way that they evolve through post-production. The sound editor is chiefly responsible for interacting with the director from the phase when production basically ends And they have a 10-week period of time to do their director's cut before showing to the studio. During that time, they spend time cutting the picture, but they also spend time conceiving the sound. And the sound editor's job is to go through the picture with the director, discuss story points, discuss ambiences, discuss mood. And they're then tasked with coming up with all the sounds that will go in the film. Oftentimes, you have a production track, which is shot with a microphone like a Sennheiser 416 or Shep's. It's a very narrow band, and it's meant primarily to record very high-quality recordings of the actors' voices, but it does a very bad job of recording background sounds that are surrounding the actors. Mm-hmm. And because of that, we have the whole palette of the full theater experience in terms of the space of the theater to create all the sounds and put them in the film. So, A, we're tasked with conceiving what the sounds will be like. We then either get the sounds by going out in the world and recording them, which we do for most every film we do at Sound Deluxe, which is the company that I started and working at all these years. And then we have our librarians, which have been with us, I'd say, going on 17 some odd years. We've had at least three people full time for the last 17 years. They work for our division called the Hollywood Edge, which is the library division for all of Sound Deluxe and Todd AO. And they go through and they take all the field recordings and they clean them up and they take noise out as needed, catalog them, and then put them on a server so all of our editors across the city can get to them quickly and easily. And then we go through the process of sitting with editors or designers on each of the projects and giving them input about the story and discussions with the directors. And then they go out and start to block out the sounds by actually taking the sounds and putting them in against the picture, which means you've got the picture running in real time, and then you have the sound running on different tracks, which used to be on 35 millimeter, one track at a time. And now that's done on a wonderful device called Pro Tools, which is a device that gives you many, many tracks. And today, on my very laptop that I'm talking to you, I can run several hundred tracks with 192 outputs playing simultaneously. So it really gives the sound editor a chance to hear everything together, which has been a big evolution. We can talk more about that later. But all the sounds are put into place. So they're recorded or they're taken from a library. They're selected for their aesthetics and the way they work with the picture. They're then put against the picture, meaning edited against the picture directly on their own tracks. And then they're supplied to the mixing stage for the final mix process. The sound supervisor is also responsible for recording something called Foley, which is named after a gentleman by the name of Jack Foley. It was invented in the 1950s. And it's used to create sync-specific sound effects that are recorded to the picture in a room called a Foley stage. And it's a great environment. It's like a big play chest. They've got every kind of prop you can ever imagine to make sounds that are then used to fill in that three-dimensional thing I was talking about earlier, because you can record specific large things, but also very intimate small things like hands touching hands or face or whiskers or lifting a glass up. And those things help create a three-dimensionality that's really some fantastic to make a film come alive. The last element that we deal with is ADR, automated dialogue replacement, which used to be referred to as looping. And that's when you might have a contaminated recording. Let's say you're in a busy Western town where they didn't have cars, but you're shooting right next to the freeway and you want to eliminate some cars that you may have there, or you may want to change a performance. In those cases, the actors come back to a stage that's a environment that is completely clean, has no noise in it. They will re-record their performance, and then we put that in against the picture. So all of those things happen during the preparatory phase, along with the production and recording of the musical score. And then from that point in time, we go into the mixing phase, where the sound editors work in close harmony with the re-recording mixers and actually mix all these sounds together for the final mix and sometimes preview mixes. So it's an evolutionary process. As the picture gets cut, the sound gets selected and placed, goes into the picture, and then the picture gets mixed, and then we finish our job sometimes about 2 weeks before a movie's release. So we're right there. When the billboards are up, we're still working.
Well, I've heard that often about movie making, that the things are often pushed up to the last instant.
They are. Yes, oftentimes a director will, you know, wait until the very last minute when they just wrench it from their hands And, you know, they've got to go because it has to be printed at the lab. But, you know, we try and be done a little bit sooner than that. But I have been in situations where that does happen. And, you know, people want to work as long as they can because, you know, forever is a long time. And everyone feels that way about these projects we work on.
Sure. And once it's done, once it's in the can and out in the world, it is there essentially forever, isn't it?
It is, truly. And particularly, you know, it's interesting. I know that your show is primarily about, you know, the home theater market and the home theater world. And, and interestingly enough, the home theater version of these movies is the thing that essentially lives forever in most cases, because film prints, you know, oftentimes, you know, end up in a vault somewhere. And even the digital masters for things that are running in cinemas very rarely run second, third runs in cinemas unless it's a special re-release. So the home theater components and the way that we master those are truly important because they do they're the ones that last forever. And it's just interesting to note the difference between them. And I'm sure we'll get into that later.
And I do want to get into that, absolutely. But before we do, I just wanted to pass on a couple questions already from the chat room, some of which you've already answered. B00 asked, what is the main software you use for audio editing? And I think you answered that. It's Pro Tools, right?
Yeah, Pro Tools has become the de facto standard. There were in the mid-80s, when we started out with sort of the green line computers, there was the AMS Audiophile was one of the first computers used for that. There was then something called the Waveframe. And then along came this company, DigiDesign, who built the Pro Tools. And that has become the standard for audio editing. And we're up just installing Pro Tools 10 across Tadeo and Sound Deluxe and the rest of our company. So Pro Tools keeps evolving. It's an amazing, amazing machine that allows us to do just so many things. And it's really invigorated the ability to do stuff for me personally and for people doing sound work, because you can just do so many things right there in your studio.
And not only movie soundtracks, but music recordings as well. I think that's pretty much a standard recording platform now for multi-track music recordings.
It is. People are using Pro Tools for music recordings. They're using it for game sound, for television. It's pretty much become a standard. And the advantage of that for the people doing this creative work is, you know, once you learn how to use this platform, you can go and work in all these different areas. So anyone that's interested in doing sound work, I recommend strongly that you do take the time and try and learn how to use the Pro Tools device. It's a great device.
Now, you're referring to it as a device or a machine, but it's really primarily software, right?
It is software, yes. It runs on a Mac computer. I don't believe there's a PC version of it, but yes, it is software. And in fact, the boxes have slowly but surely disappeared. When I used to run things on my laptop, it had a box about this big, then it got this big, then it got this big, and now it's just a dongle and everything runs natively on my computer. So there you go.
Right, exactly. Such is the world of technology, definitely.
It is, yes.
Davnell in the chat room asks a question you also already answered. Is the Foley stage still in use, or are all sound effects digital recordings now?
The Foley stage is very much in use. It's used on every project, from every television show to every feature film, and even games for the interstitial films that you see on a lot of video games. Digital, yes, that's true. We record things digitally, but, you know, just because you record or store something or edit something digitally doesn't mean it's, quote, digital. It had to have been recorded somewhere in nature, whether it be on a stage or whether it be outside. It's always got to be recorded in some manner.
Now, I guess you couldn't like record generic footsteps or hand motions or scratches of on a stubble or on a face or something like that and use them from one movie to the next. You really have to kind of record those for each movie because each movie's requirements are a little different. Am I right about that?
Not exactly. When I mentioned earlier that sometimes we get sounds from our library, you know, all those sounds were recorded at one time or another. And for the movies that have the budgets, we certainly do everything custom every time and we start from scratch. And even in some cases, like on The Hunger Games, I actually recorded a lot of the stuff outside, which I can talk about separately, just to make it sound unique and sound more real. And it was really a good success, one that I'd worked on for years. But getting back to the question at hand, no, you can use hand pats and things like that, rubbing, you know, hand rubbings and movements. We save libraries of those, and particularly for projects that are budget challenged, or they have a time constraint problem, or we need a sound quickly on a mix to get something quickly. We have those things in our library, which is almost 450,000 sounds fully cataloged in our library. And even footsteps, we did come up with a system called the DFS system, the Digital Foley system, that did take banks of footsteps. I had a young man spending a year going through and clipping single footsteps and putting them to the banks on a playback device that you could, it was velocity sensitive. And for a long time, we have been using that for certain television shows, and it works great. It actually switches from walking type feet to jogging to running. It's the same shoes, same surface, but it actually changes velocity depending on how you utilize the system. So we use technology in many, many ways. We high tech and low tech.
Let's see. Web 6874 asks, what is the hardest sound to implement in the movie? Are there any sounds that are harder to do than others?
There are. And, you know, it's interesting. I would say that the hardest sound to implement in a movie is crowds of people. You know, getting a crowd of people to react back and forth with the scene at hand and have it sound natural is extremely complicated and difficult because, first of all, recording crowds is very difficult because you rarely have large groups of people in a quiet environment that you where you can control them. And so, A, getting the material is difficult, and then getting it to match in a specific scene where you where things will be much shorter, no doubt, than how you originally recorded it, and getting natural beginnings and ends, like a single person starting to clap, a second, a third, a fifth, you know, and then a 50 and 100, or maybe a whistle or two and going up and down. And we just recently, in fact, in the last two films I did, the last one, which is What to Expect When You're Expecting, which is coming out from Lionsgate Studios on the 18th of May, and The Hunger Games, we both had big crowd sequences in them, and they needed a great deal of attention to make them sound natural in terms of their beginnings and ends, and laughs happen when people are, they should be laughing, and titters, and, you know, little whistles. So getting those to sound real is complicated, and it takes a lot of editing right in the material. And of course, that can be difficult because things get cut off, etc. So I say that those are more difficult, certainly, than a gun battle or something like that, where the material is pretty straight ahead and broken into small pieces.
I can't see the name. Uzi Galil in the chat room asks, why do sound people add sounds to firearms that don't exist or wouldn't happen in real life?
You know, that's a great question. And the answer to that question is that there's a nomenclature that comes with movies that has been around for decades. And when I really appreciate that question because, you know, aside from the gunshots, which I'll talk about in a second, you know, having their own unique additive sounds, there's even the sounds when you hear a gun moved in a movie and it makes a noise. It actually makes a noise. You know, guns would never do that, of course, because, you know, if they made noises, they'd be dangerous to use and they would have a loose part. But it's because for the same reason that when someone moves their head even in a film or whatever, or brushes their cloth on their shirt, you hear it. And that's because microphones pick up things in a way different than people's ears actually hear them. So as far back as the talkies started, the sound pickup of these microphones was recording sounds of things that were very different than our ear, meaning like you could hear skin rubbing on skin or even someone turning their head, sound of their neck hitting their shirt. You'd hear that. And it's become part of the norm of the experience of recorded a film. And without it, and when we believe me, we play it without it because we see it without it all the time, those things sound empty. They don't have that three dimension to them. So that has to do with the movement of guns, which you'll always hear, which I think is always funny. But we do it because it's what people, it's part of our job, you know, part of the nomenclature, like I say. But in terms of weapons, you know, weapons are recorded in very great detail for lots of different projects. We go out and record them all the time. You know, we get excited about new gun recordings. You know, an AK-47 sounds different than an M16. A 50 cal sounds different than, you know, a myriad other guns. So we do record them. However, they often, in the recording process, we come to the same limitations of microphones. They often overload microphones and need to be slowed down or need to be fattened in some way to make them sound exciting. So to answer, you know, the question in the chat room, they are evolved, shall I say, purposefully for aesthetic reasons. Because at the end of the day, you want a film to be entertainment. It is not a documentary of a real situation. It's entertainment. And that's part of what we do. And in fact, I'll give you a quick story. I just did this film called Drive, which a lot of people have seen. People, if you haven't seen it, you should see it. But here was a movie about the main character driver who's driving this car all the time. And when I got with the director, Nick Reffin, at the beginning of the preparatory process, I said, well, you know, there were certain cars they were putting engines in, and do you want this to be a 289 or do you want this to be a 457 or how should these engines be? And he said, you know, frankly, I don't even have a license. I've never driven a car. Wow, you're kidding, right?
And he said, my God. The director of this movie had never driven a car.
Never driven a car. And he did this wonderful, one of the best car chases filmed since The French Connection. But what he said was very interesting. He said, you know, it has to be exciting. And it doesn't matter what kind of car engine it is, as long as it's exciting. And he directed me towards a Claude Lelouch film called Chase Through Paris, which is an 8-minute film, all point of view, racing through the streets of Paris with shifting and skidding and all these things. And in fact, when you look at that or you do any research on that, the film, in fact, the guy's going 35 miles an hour. And it was all about the sound effects that made it exciting. So in Drive, we did exactly the same thing. There are cases where our main character has his right hand on the steering wheel, which he would need to shift, obviously. Mm-hmm. And the car is shifting, you know, it's shifting up, it's shifting down to make it more exciting. And no one has noticed that. So
would we call that a continuity problem in a sense?
You know, if someone wrote in, it would be a continuity problem. On the other hand, I would call it the sleight of hand that movie making is about. You know, movies are sleight of hand in every manner you can imagine, whether the camera's placed to see, you know, an old Western street. And like I mentioned earlier, and right to the right of it is the, you know, the Hollywood freeway. And the camera's meant to just go to the edge of the set. It's all make-believe. And the sleight of hand is sound is a big part of that sleight of hand about making it seem real. And it suspends your disbelief. And you go with a story. And if we've done a good job, you don't know we've done anything because it all seems like it happened.
Yeah, yeah. Now, you worked on The Hunger Games, and that's obviously a really big movie these days. Can you tell us any anecdotes, any stories from that project that were unusual or interesting?
Well, there's a bunch of interesting stories from that project related to sound, which was fantastic because we had so many opportunities. I got involved with the project during pre-production with Gary Ross and Phil Messina, our production designer, and went through Susan Collins' book and went through the script and made extensive notes about things that we could shoot and things that would make sure to make sounds, and then you know, put together the soundscape from there. One of them, you know, there's a bunch of interesting things that were created for that film. For instance, the Tracker Jacker sequence, which are these mutated wasps. When I first started thinking about them, was in the summer of 2010, I believe. And my son, who was a mountain bike racer, was out at a mountain bike race. I went out to see him. And there they have all the kids on their trainers race, getting their legs warmed up. And they made the most amazing buzzing sound I'd ever heard before. Ten
wow.
kids had mountain bikes with their treads, you know. So I got my my recorder, which I usually have with me to record them, and brought them back, and we were all excited about them. And those became the basis of how we came up with the Tracker Jacker sounds, not exclusively with the constant sound of them rubbing on the trainer wheel, but we also started to get other things, very organic little things like a zip tie or some cardboard or different surfaces. And when the rider would zip up at the speed, we might zip that off the treads or try different treads and things. And that's how we got the flying in and flying out. And we made the sounds of the Tracker Jackers in that for that film.
Were there any actual real wasp sounds in those in that sound?
There are some real wasp sounds. Yeah, for sure. And they are, and in some cases, those are like the glue. You know, sometimes you'll use a, like we call it audio putty. It's one of my favorite terms. There's certain sounds that work to hold other sounds together. Mm-hmm. For instance, in the night sequences in that film, there's also, I wanted the, Gary and I agreed that, Gary Ross, our director, and I agree that the arena should have a sort of real yet controlled quality to it because it's in fact this big game arena. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to, pursue having things in nature in the night ambience that would be, unreal, but sound real. And I was visiting up in Door County a year ago and I found this little music shop in Wisconsin. And they had these frogs about, well, different sizes. And they on the back of them, they had little raised sections. And with a mallet, you could scrape them and rub them. And they sounded like frogs. So I immediately, you know, bought every size one they had. I came back to the Foley stage, which is a nice, quiet environment. And with a group of five or six talented players, we performed these frog symphonies. And in fact, that's what appears in with real frogs in the night sequences in the arena. And they sound real, but they also sound slightly made up. And that was exactly what I wanted them to do. I wanted them to feel like we're in a real place, but the place is conjured at the behest of the gameskeepers. And that was another example of coming up with something that, that wasn't real, but right. played into the story. Because it all comes back to the story. You want to tell the story all the time.
Yes, exactly. And this is the point I always try to make whenever I talk about home theater or about movies in general is really what we're doing is trying to convey a story as richly and as entertainingly as we possibly can.
That's exactly right. And the story comes from the script. And, the characters are put into a environment or a situation, and they're going through that. And the subtext of which is really important because it has to have come from the costume design and the props, the props that are supplied and camera work, the editing, and the sound. And the sound, the details of the sound and how it is, I mentioned the process of selecting the right sound, but then playing it appropriately, having the cadence of it be proper when we're off stage. Like if you have a, say, a factory sequence and you might have something like a pile driver or something in the background creating a cadence, you know, you can change and manipulate those things and how fast or slow they go. And you can change the mood of a scene by how you deal with things such as cadence, as well as sound selection and level. Mm-hmm. And things like equalization and reverberation, those sorts of things also set the scene. Yeah. So they do really tell the story. If a character has a limp, you know, we'll put a limp in their footsteps, or we'll put a creak on their shoe. Or if they're in an old house, or they might be poorer than another character, which might be richer. You know, the poor character might have certain things that might personify living in a poor area, such as an industrial background, or maybe, like I said, the floorboards might not be as solid, and someone in a more bourgeois-type environment, they might have a grandfather clock or something that personifies sort of, you know, not having things be as difficult. So we try and tell those stories at every turn.
And you get down to some pretty tiny details, like you're saying, creaking floorboards in a poorer house and a grandfather clock and even perhaps probably a quieter, more hushed ambience in a richer house because there's more drapery, it's more solidly built and so on like that. You're really thinking about things down to that level.
Even the clothing. I mean, when we go through to do cloth, you know, one thing we do for every movie, people probably don't know this, but, you know, the Foley, I mentioned earlier, it's used for three dimensionality. But there's a bigger reason we do Foley for all these projects, which is for the foreign language versions. You know, when they record on a set, a bunch of people talking, and it's time to put in the foreign languages, you have to turn off the recording that you did on the set because it's all English, save a little pieces of movement or other things you might have recorded on the set. But you have to go through, and with Foley, we record all the footsteps, all the cloth movement, all the hand pats, all of the elements that, again, if I remember back when I said the nomenclature of film sound has to do with recording movement, recording feet, all these things, because the way microphones pick things up, when you go to put in other languages, you have to have all those elements available. So when you go off to a foreign territory such as Germany or Spain or France or Asia, any of these countries, they put in their language, you have to have all those sounds there. Otherwise, you're not going to end up basically with the same film. So you're getting so what I meant to say was part of that is recording cloth movement. And you actually go through and the Foley artist looks at the screen. And when the person turns their head or moves their arm, they move a piece of cloth, which we choose different types of cloth. Like we mentioned earlier, the poor or the rich might be grittier, right. Might be softer, might have more of a sheen to it. But those things are recorded for use in the foreign tracks because, again, when you pull that production track out, you not only lose the dialogue, but you often lose all those other minute details that the microphones picked up. So there's thousands upon thousands of sound choices and sounds that get added into every film and television show. It's really something. It's quite a tapestry.
Yeah, yeah. Davnell in the chat room asked a great question, which gets back again to not necessarily being realistic in order to serve the story, which is why do things like rocket engines make noise in space? Which, of course, they wouldn't.
How do you know?
In space, no one can hear you scream.
Right. We always have to ask that question. Does the tree make a sound in the forest if no one's there to hear it?
Oh, that's a very good philosophical question. That
maybe, maybe not. It depends if they covered it when they did the re-recording.
Well, I think we can say fairly safely that in space, sound is not transmitted in space. I mean, we know this from physics, right? I mean,
we know that from physics. Yeah, sound waves have nothing to bounce against because, of course, sound waves are emitted waves that bounce against the atmosphere. And that's what causes the vibrations, what causes sound. But the answer is, it's all about the story. And if you watch a sequence in space with no sounds for the rockets and no music playing, you will probably be looking at your watch and wanting to get up and leave and go do something else.
Well, music I can understand because music we know is, you know, the score of the movie, and we know we're watching a movie, and okay, so they put some music in. But I've often wondered this myself as someone trained in physics. Two things often come to mind when watching space stories. One is, yeah, here's the sound in space. That wouldn't be happening. The other is that the spaceships don't move as they would in space. They move as if they're grabbing air. Now, you don't deal with that, of course. You're dealing with the sound. And I think you've answered this before, that in terms of the sound, that does make for a more compelling movie experience if you hear a sound of a rocket, even though you wouldn't in space.
Yeah, it definitely makes for more of a compelling experience. And in fact, it helps convey the size sometimes. You know, it's not just about the speed. It sometimes helps convey the size of a spaceship. Mm-hmm. That's one of the things you're trying to do often is at Sound Deluxe, we've done most of the Star Trek films. You want to convey the size of these huge ships. Well, you can do it visually to some degree by having them and having other ships, different size. You can see the relationship, but having a presence of that, you mentioned music. We're part of the orchestra.
Yes.
We're just part of the orchestra, and we're some of the notes that are played as part of the musical score in a film. And, sometimes you might even have music. You mentioned music as a score, that we can accept that. You would also accept it if you heard it, futzed like it's over a little tinny radio going through the space, which we've done before, and it would sound like, oh, that's probably from inside the spaceship, and it's like a piece of source that's played as overscore,
right,
as opposed to underscore. So there's lots of devices that we use all the time,
yes,
both musically and and with sound and with dialogue to tell the story.
Web 6874 in the chat room asks another question. What is the most used sound in movie? What's the most commonly used? Is there one sample in the library that's used most often? And I would conjecture it might be, I forget the name of it. I learned this on a previous show. This one particular scream that gets used everywhere. It has a name. I forget what it is.
Don't hold me to the name because I don't know it offhand, but I know the one you're talking about.
Yes.
And I think there's a certain sound designer or two that use that one. I personally use this pile driver sound I mentioned earlier in most every film I do and have for 30 years. So, we all have our favorites. The most popular sounds are often weapons, because a lot of movies have weapons in them and gunshots. A 45 is always very popular. We also, I would say there's a lot of car chases in films. So the action films use a lot of skids. I'd say skids are very popular. Skids gunshots. Those are the most popular. It used to be horses, but they don't do that many westerns anymore. So the horses are out. And, the more modern cars are in. And then the car engines change, of course, over time. I did a film last year, or a couple years ago, called The Next 3 Days, a wonderful film Paul Haggis directed. And, the main character had a Prius. So, there was a scene with Jason.
Oh, man, there's almost no sound from a Prius. I just got one, in fact.
Well, it's interesting. They do make a sound, and it's a very unique sound. There's a very unique whine that comes out of that engine.
It's true.
And any Prius owner would recognize that whine pretty quickly. And we needed to record that. And when we did record it, we had several microphones, some near the tailpipe that would record the motor when it kicks in. But then some we had attached to the engine itself and the electronics, which recorded separately that whine that I'm referring to. And then on the in the post-production process, we would take those multi-track recordings, usually 8 different microphones, and mix them together to get the change between what might be the tailpipe and what might be the engine, depending on the scene, how close the car was to us or how far away it was and how intensely it was being driven.
Right.
So again, another bunch of detail, taking a recording and turning
That's
it
right.
into, there's a whole bunch of prep here. It's like painting your house. You have to do a lot of prep before you actually start painting.
John, our engineer, reminded me that the name of that scream is the Wilhelm Scream.
That's the name of it, the Wilhelm Scream. Thank you, John. Very fun.
Let's see. We got a bunch of other questions here. Let's see here. Virgil was asking if you could describe the famous Dirty Harry scene in term from a sound supervisor's point of view. I'm not quite sure I know which scene he's referring to. Do you? There's a famous Dirty Harry scene.
I don't.
But we'll ask. We'll ask him to specify that. Beatmaster asks, which was crazier for you to do, Natural Born Killers or Braveheart?
I would say that Braveheart was a much more completely involving project because it had so many different things going on, and it was a time period film, and there was a lot of things to create in that film. There were some huge, huge battle sequences with mounted horseback, and there was lots of scenes with people. We talked about people earlier and crowds, and that film was a real labor of love for the people involved with it. We all, when we first saw it and first started putting together, everyone was really thrilled with the story that was being told and the scope of it. And that project involved a lot of recording of things, from the weapons to the horses to the arrows to the, you know, all kinds of things. And it was a great experience. So, you know, none of them are easy, though. I'll tell you, you do a simple project that's got a lot of dialogue in it, maybe not a lot of huge epic action, but it's still very complicated because the dialogue tracks may be super complicated. And when I say that, I mean there's a lot of angles that might be cut together to make one performance of an actor and actress. So there's no project where it's you know, super easy to put together.
Super simple, yeah.
Simple,
yeah.
Not simple, very complicated tapestries of thousands of pieces of sound that come together.
There was a question in the chat room that reminded me, you just mentioned the word dialogue, and there was a question, I'm looking back for it, I may not be able to find it easily, about the mixing of dialogue in terms of level and how mm-hmm. that relates to the rest of the sound, in particular in action movies, when there's a lot of action going on, the dialogue might be a little too low to understand. How do you approach that problem?
Well, dialogue being too low to understand is a problem you can have in a lot of different movies, and that's not just action movies. That certainly is sometimes a problem when you have a filmmaker that thinks they need a lot of volume to make their action sequences more exciting. And that happens a lot, by the way, where there's a feeling like it's not exciting enough, let's make it louder. I personally, you know, if you look at my credit list, I don't do a lot of big action movies. It's just not the thing I'm interested in, and nor is the thing I've done. I really like mixes that are more delicate and more, you know, just, I guess, quieter, you could say. And the movies I've done have had most are those types of movies. But to get back to the dialogue, how do we handle it? Generally what happens now, and the film sound, the approach to film sound has changed over, you know, every 10 years, and certainly during the 30-some-odd years I've been doing it. But the current way that we often go through a scene, after we've pre-mixed all of the dialogue and all the effects and those things in advance, is we'll go through for the final mix and we'll go through and lay in the dialogue and the music, rough them in, shall I say, but where the dialogue is your base. This is the level the dialogue has to play to be at the right level in relationship to the screen, because all the sounds have to have a correct relationship to the screen. You don't want yourself leaning in going, what, or leaning back going, oh, it's too loud, you know, turn it down.
Yeah,
there's a perfect relationship that those two things have, the sound and the picture. So we generally will lay in the dialogue first, go through a scene or the reel or whatever, which is a 20-minute section of a film. Usually there's 5 or 6 reels, sometimes 7. And we lay the dialogue and the music so the music works, or it's underscore, overscore, whatever, and we get it to play properly. And then the effects are laid in next. The effects mixer, who's usually a separate person, because nowadays we work with 2-man teams. One is the dialogue and music mixer, and the other one mixes all the effects. And they go in and they lay in the effects, and they get that working. So you really play it so you can hear it, but then you start coming across issues where the effects, there's a big action scene and you want, you know, there's a big explosion or there's a crash or something, you know, a chase scene where it's getting more and more frenetic and more and frenetic and there's impact. And then they have, you know, they have a guy talking in the car to another guy or something, or a gal and a guy. And you go, oh, I want to hear that dialogue. Well, either you start raising things and raising, you know, the dialogue, the effects, the file effects, the music, the effects, the music, or you go, no, no, no. We know this is our nominal dialogue level. Let's carve holes around the dialogue and make space for it. And that is the way to do it, in my opinion, because if you keep raising things, it just gets louder and louder. And you start to lean back like this from the screen, which is just not the goal, in my opinion. There are times, however, when you want the audience to be slightly overwhelmed or greatly overwhelmed for a short time, and they do have to pick out the dialogue or they do have to kind of get their ears around it. That's part of it. But I think that that really happens. It should happen in very specific instances that have to do with the story or the state of mind the character's in. If it's a subjective situation where maybe they're not sure what's going on. Like in The Hunger Games, there's a sequence where Katniss goes to blow up all of these supplies that the tributes, the career tributes have. And after the explosion, she basically goes deaf for a short time. And there's a moment where you can barely hear them coming back and they're talking to this kid and whatever, and you can barely hear their voices. It's muted and super distant. In a case like that, it's supposed to be muted and distant. You're not supposed to have a clear understanding.
Because you're supposed to be hearing it as if Katniss, as Katniss is hearing it, right?
Exactly. So it's part of the storytelling. And in that picture in particular, everything had to be told from her perspective all the time. And that's part of why I think that film was so successful. But just to get back to that general dialogue question, it is a problem. We often have to spend a lot of time and we go back and forth and back and forth. And that's what takes time when you mix a movie. Sometimes it takes weeks and weeks to mix a movie. It doesn't happen in 3 or 4 days. It can take weeks.
As you say, going back and forth and back and forth.
Yeah, we look at it thousands of times. And by the end of it, you know it all pretty clear. You know all the dialogue pretty well.
Hopefully. I'm sure. I'm getting a question multiple times in the chat room. What is your favorite microphone? Do you have one?
You know, for the longest times, it was the Shepps, which was great for point source recordings. But now I think it's called the DP5100, which is a 5-channel microphone. It's actually this triangle thing and it has 5 different microphones in it. And I use that extensively for the crowd and ambient recordings on The Hunger Games. I went back to Colby, North Carolina, where The Reaping was shot, and was also in Charlotte, North Carolina for the big parade sequence and was able to record a lot of the crowds there. And that microphone is a fantastic microphone because it really gives you the chance to record things in true 5-1, left, center, right, left, surround, right, surround. And that's my new favorite microphone.
Right. Okay, good. I'm gonna ask you more about 5.1 multi-channel mixes and so on, and also the difference between commercial cinema and home theater. But before I do, I want to take a moment to thank our sponsor for this episode, which is Netflix. And of course, on Netflix, you can see many of the movies that Lon has done instantly, streaming them directly to your PC or your TV. Using just about any consumer electronics device on the market these days. They all have a Netflix app, including TVs and Blu-ray players, gaming consoles, standalone devices, Roku boxes, even tablets and smartphones. They can all stream Netflix to any display, basically, that you have in your house. And you can even start watching on one device and finish on another if that's what you'd like to do. And you can stream all of these movies instantly without having to wait for discs by mail. You can do that too if you want, but there really is no need to. If you just want to get it right away, you have instant gratification on many, many titles, thousands of TV episodes and movies available by streaming from Netflix. And for Twit listeners, they're even offering a 30-day free trial. All you have to do is go to netflix.com/twit. Be sure to use that URL when you're signing up for your 30-day free trial at netflix.com/twit. And we thank Netflix very much for their support of Home Theater Geeks and the Twit Network. So, Lon, before we get into multi-channel sound and so on, Virgil found the scene that from Dirty Harry that he meant, which was the "Do You Feel Lucky" punk scene. Did you do that movie? Did you do that movie?
I don't think so. I think that my father or grandfather would have done that movie. Now, that was a little bit before my
time. A little bit before your time. Okay.
All right. It was. But well, if I remember correctly, though, that just quickly, you know, the things that was great about that scene is that there was a real definition of the idea that these characters were all alone facing off with each other. And the sound and lack of sound, if I remember correctly, was really a big part of that. You know, sometimes the lack of sound is the big part of something that really hones your attention right into the emotion of characters. And by manipulating how much or how little sound we have, it can really, you know, put the characters really close to each other in a way, or the audience close to the characters. So if I'm remembering correctly, that was one of the most interesting parts of that sequence, is they really were cognizant of how much sound they were using.
Right. It seems to me that movies have so much sound going on most of the time that when something when it's silent for a moment, that actually draws your attention because of the lack of sound.
That's true. I've been, you know, it's interesting as an artist, a sonic artist, I guess. I mean, you know, all the people doing sound work are basically, you know, people that are artists working with sound. You know, your perspective changes over the years. You know, you're doing something for 30 years, you're going to change in the way that you do things. And as I grew up in this business and watched the advent of, you know, Dolby stereo and four channel, we had a left, center, right, a surround, and wow, you could move stuff around and it was great. And then you got split surrounds with the 5.1 system, and you could put stuff in the left side in the back and the right side in the back. And now you have 7.1 and you can get to the sidewalls and pull things off the screen without having to put it behind you. You know, there was a propensity in the 80s and 90s to really have a lot of movement with sound and stuff happening everywhere and moving. Even there were even times when they would have dialogue walk out the door with someone, and you know, all kinds of things like that. Mm. And I went through that, I suppose, like everyone else did. But you know, the way I feel now in 2012 is simpler sound, less dense sound, things that really specify a situation and a character's perspective. I've keyed into that more for sure in the last couple of years. Nicholas Winding Refn, our director on Drive, just 2 years ago, really taught me a lot. He's a Danish filmmaker, wonderful filmmaker, and he taught me a great deal about the idea of what's important when it comes to sound and what's not important. And I think on Hunger Games, we did the same thing. We really played the sound very delicately and very specific to every moment. There's not a wasted sound moment. And it's never too loud and never too quiet for a, you know, long period of time. And it's always telling the story. And I really, that's what I'm honing into now. You know, ask me another 10 years, I may have something different to tell you. But that's where I am now. And every person evolves as they go along in their career, sure, particularly a creative endeavor. You know?
So yeah, that's absolutely
how I feel now. Yeah.
So earlier in the show, you alluded to this question, and I really want to make sure we get to it, which is the difference between mixing for movies in the commercial cinema and at home. I know that you just finished just a few days ago, I think, the mixing the Blu-ray for Hunger Games. And I'm curious to know what the difference is. How do you approach them? And what differences do you need to take into account?
Well, it's interesting. The cinematic environment that most people will see movies in is a environment where they're much farther away from the speakers than they are in a near field environment, like at a home theater. Mm. Uh-huh. So because of that, the sort of mix of the sound waves all coming together sort of smooths themselves out in that environment. And it creates a very different distinction between the locations and the dynamics than a home theater environment does. So you will have generally too much dynamics from a theatrical mix than is appropriate for a home theater mix. And when I say that, what I mean to say is the quiet stuff's too quiet and the loud stuff is too loud. And mm-hmm. I don't know how many people out there have had the situation that I've had where I'm, you know, clicking up for the quieter stuff and something loud comes in, I'm clicking down real quickly because it's too loud.
I do that sometimes. Haven't you? Absolutely. Yeah, okay. Absolutely.
There you go. So I am a proponent of decreasing that dynamic range considerably. Not considerably, but just a few dB, raising the low stuff a couple dB, and lowering the loud stuff a dB or two. And what it does, it reduces the overall dynamic range, which isn't as important because, again, because the speakers are closer to you, you're going to have more dynamic range anyway because you're going to hear more detail from the speakers. You know, imagine taking a source and having it really right here. You're going to hear a certain amount of detail. And as it goes farther into the distance, detail will decrease because of the sound waves sort of dispersing into the space.
Right.
So oftentimes we find that there are some mixes. Again, this has changed over time, and it continues to change. So all I can talk about is the most recent thing I did, which is Hunger Games, right? So
right.
In that particular case, we made choices to decrease dynamic range, and we also decided which is done in most theaters. I'm sorry, most home theater mixes. The sub basses are often not supported by a lot of 5.1 home systems, and even though a lot of them have them, other ones don't have them. So we try and move as much sub information out of the sixth channel, which is that 5.1. That's that 0.1, the sub channel.
The 0.1, yeah.
Yeah, or 7.1 in the case of Hunger Games. We actually did a 7.1 theatrical mix, and we did a 7.1 home theater mix. But we would move the sub, just to get back to the point, we would move the sub bass into the mains as much as we possibly could.
Now wait a second, though, because just to interrupt and address that point, many people have their receivers or pre-pros set so that any low-frequency components in the main channels get directed back to the sub.
Which it will do. So that way, right. By putting the information into the mains, it goes back to their sub if they have one.
Right.
And that's
but if they
the
don't, then
feature.
I see your point.
If they don't have one, it'll still play as much sub information as we can put into the mains, which works over 100 cycles. You know, the subs are generally working 60 and below. So between 60 and 100 is sort of a gray area. But, you know, you can get a lot of low-end energy into the mains in order to allow people to hear that material in their home theaters. Mm-hmm. And then there's home theaters, you know, that aren't 5.1 home theaters. They're people that just have an LCR home theater or they have a stereo. And so we have actually, on Hunger Games, we made a separate stereo mix that's made specifically for people that have stereo componentry in their homes. Mm-hmm. Because what happens is the 7.1 will do an automatic down convert to 5.1, and the 5.1 do automatic down converts to two-track, LTR team. Right. Left total, right total, which is a Dolby surround format. So the ability to choose these other mixes, by the way, often do appear on your menu. So if you are a audiophile person and you want to really determine the mix you're hearing, do look at the menu on the DVD itself, because oftentimes you may find a separate 5.1 mix or a separate stereo mix, and you then won't be relying on the down convert process to make that change for you. Now,
you'll be listening to someone, to the results of someone like you making a specific stereo mix.
That's correct. But in defense of the down convert process, it does work very well. I mean, we spent a lot of time on Hunger Games. We did make a 5.1 mix and a stereo mix, because I think we're going to try and fit all of them on the disc, although don't quote me on that. but the down convert, when AB, the 7.1 down convert, which had unique material in this particular case in the side wall speakers as opposed to material that was pulled forward from the surround or pulled back from the left and right fronts, when those down converts were compared, which we did all the way through as we were doing it, to the 5.1 theatrical master, it was very, very close. We didn't really have as much discrepancy as one might think. So DTS and Dolby both provide the down convert process. They both do a great job, and that's how it's often done. Because there's there's a limited amount of space on these Blu-rays, even though they have a lot of space. There's a lot of things they're packing in there. So oftentimes you will see a 7.1 that's down converted to 5.1 and 2-track, or if it's just a 5.1 mix, you'll see that automatically down converted to the 2-track.
What about EQ and dialogue? We were talking about dialogue before, and I wonder if you change the level of the dialogue in the home theater mix at all. And then also, what differences in EQ? For example, I know that THX talks about re-EQ, because the EQ for commercial cinemas, you have to, I think, boost the highs a little bit because the speakers are behind a perforated screen, and that may very well not be the case in the home.
In terms, there's two different questions. I'll try and answer them separately.
Yeah.
The level of the dialogue usually is a problem in low-level sequences more than regular straight dialogue. So okay. If you're playing a scene where people are talking like we're talking now, and there's plenty of level on the microphone, generally those aren't the issues. Generally the issues is if it's too low, like it's a scene where people are whispering maybe, or they're talking quietly and there's competing sounds, or a scene where you have a very busy restaurant sequence and you're trying to hear the dialogue. In those cases, we might raise the dialogue, not straight through, but we'll actually mix it a little bit. You know, they actually do a mix. They don't just process these things. Someone's very talented mixer sits and can spend a couple of days doing a mix. So we'll go through the lines and we actually sit and raise the lines we can't hear and try and make them a little bit clearer. In terms of the equalization, a lot of energy in the human voice is around the 2K frequency between, 1/8 to 2K and 3,500 or so, 4,000 at the top end.
And yeah, so that's about where the consonants lie and many of the consonants, and that therefore where most of the meaning in language lies.
That's correct. So in those cases, we would go ahead and we might change the EQ and add a little EQ into those particular areas where it might be difficult. But we do not process the whole tracks. Definitely not, because that then takes away, if you knew the amount, or I can convey to the audience the amount of detail we spend with EQ with the theatrical mixes, everything is very specific, including EQ. So we may spend a lot of time adding a little bit of warmth either to a piece of dialogue, to an actor, to an actress, or to an environment, or to a car engine. And as soon as you start making wholesale changes in the EQ that aren't specified to a certain scene or a certain moment, I think it's maybe not the best course of action, really.
One last topic. We have a few minutes left about sound in 3D movies. Of course, 3D movies are pretty big these days. They were bigger, I think, last year. I think they've reached a bit of a plateau in terms of popularity, but people are still making them, a bunch of them, in fact. And so I wonder if you approach sound design and sound for 3D movies differently than you do for 2D movies.
I have not done many 3D movies. I'm trying to think if I've done any 3D movies, and I don't think I have. But, the goal would be to draw, if an image is going to come, there's two different things in 3D that make them great. One is the 3D nature of environments. They're incredible. Like, you just feel this incredible depth. So from an environmental standpoint, I would endeavor to create as much depth as I can through specified sounds and different frequency ranges and different levels and different amounts of reverb to create depth. From a standpoint of something that's part of 3D, which are something that comes out at the audience, you would probably try and, pull the sound out and move it into the surrounds or move it into the sidewalls or whatever. But you have the same, the same issues in 3D as you do with a regular film in a cinema that has speakers around the outsides of the cinema. You don't have some of the amazing cinema sound systems like Isono, which came out a few years ago with 39-some-odd speakers, and they actually could place a sound sitting in a seat next to you. I saw demonstrations of it.
Yes.
So in cases like that, they would be great for 3D to really make the sound have 3D. But you can also, you have something come out of the screen at you, and you put a big screen like that goes shooting from the front to the back quickly. You'll feel it hit you and, have that experience. So we play around with that probably. Speaker, moving things into the speakers maybe a little more aggressively. And we have, now with the 7.1, we have two more sets of speakers that are very, very helpful in pulling things off the screen, making it more of a three-dimensional environment without putting it behind your head. It really comes up to the side. They do say that those should be 90 degrees from the listener for people that are setting up their home theater systems. But
Those are the side surrounds, you mean?
The side walls, they call them. Side walls.
Yeah.
And I personally would be a proponent, if I was creating the specs, of actually having it about 10 or 20 degrees ahead of the audience, the listener, because they often read, to me, even though they're 90 degrees from where my head is, they still read like they're more in the back, and I'd rather they read a little more in the front to pull things off the screen. But one of my pet peeves I just want to mention before we go off the air has to do with the details of something like that. And, the biggest pet peeve that I experience is the lack of sound reinforcement at multiplex theaters, which is a supporter of the home theater experience, which is not a thing, that the movie theater, the movie production world, nor me as a professional want to see happen, because as much as I love home theater, I want people to go to the movie theaters because that's where the experience is, as a communal experience. The problem with it that I see is one of the biggest problems isn't the popcorn and it isn't the crappy projection, which you sometimes get. But with DCP yes. now, it's better. But you get yes. all these low frequencies coming through the walls during a quiet sequence.
Theater next door.
Yeah, or the two theaters next door.
Yeah, 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 from on either side of you.
Yeah, and I went to see Hunger really Games last Sunday night with I wanted to see it with the public, and there's these quiet sequences with these beautiful score or beautiful ambiences, and all I'm hearing is this low-end, energy coming from the theaters. And I know that the Motion Picture Academy at the Oscars this year made a big attempt to try and get the message across about people going to movie theaters and going out and this and that. And I think that without talking to the exhibitors about making bigger investments in their infrastructure and separating their theaters from one another, I think we have a real problem with the movie-going experience in theaters because you really do take away from one of the most important parts of the work, which is the quiet scenes where actors and actresses are interacting about story. It's not the action sequences that are loud and overbearing.
And bombastic, so, yes.
Bombastic, muscular mixing, we call that.
Well, what can be done about that? I mean, that's an architectural issue, isn't it? I mean, you need to install better isolation between the theaters, and that's going to mean opening up the walls and doing all kinds of very expensive stuff. I mean, I don't disagree. I think you should do that, but is it practical to expect?
In my opinion, it is practical to expect. You have, ArcLight theaters and some of these other high-end theaters that are making a great experience. They want to be special, and they've got all these cool environments when you enter and when you get in the theater and assigned seating and all this stuff. And then you hear all the same crap you hear in any other theater chain. Mm-hmm. So, and I'm not pulling the ArcLight apart personally. It's any of these multiplexes. Yeah, it involves an investment in making more density in the walls, particularly where the subs are. Back walls, yes. Probably, but they should be checked by all of them. And, it's part of the investment that you make when you go in the movie theater business. And so, is it a big deal? You bet it's a big deal. And when we build sound studios, we completely float them. Mixing stages are floated rooms inside of other rooms with rubber that keeps them separated from the outside walls. And those things are really important. And, if the movie industry wants people to continue to go to movie theaters, I think they have to eliminate that particular problem, because there's no one that's gone to a multiplex that hasn't experienced that problem. And, when you're watching a movie at home, you don't have that particular problem. You have kids playing upstairs and neighbors and, you should play too loud issues if you live in a place that isn't a private home and all those things. So it's a challenge. Watching movies is a different thing than looking at a painting. No doubt about it.
Yes, exactly right. No doubt about that. And I have to tell you, you mentioned before about, home theater is great, and I'm all for it, being that I'm at hometheater.com. But I also happen to enjoy going out to the movies, again, for the communal experience.
Yeah.
As well as for much larger screen, better 3D, generally speaking, perhaps better sound. Depends on the theater, of course. You mentioned that some projection systems aren't that great. I happen to be a big fan of digital projection. I don't know how you feel about that as compared to film.
Love it.
You love it. Yes, right. And so I do enjoy going out to the movies for all of those reasons. But it does get compromised by exactly what you're talking about. You're watching a quiet scene and next door are, explosions and wars and stuff. And that intrudes on the experience, which ultimately you want to be taken away into whatever movie you're watching and not be pulled out of that into the one next door.
Yes, exactly. And, and I, as the guy who's sitting there making these soundtracks, who spent hours making a subtle scene subtle and being able to hear one little cricket come and go and hear one little creak work, I mean, there's a sequence in Hunger Games where Katniss is first shooting her bow, trying to get the attention of the sponsors when she's first being tested. And there's like a little bow creak that pulls back when she's holding it, and it creaks. And we cut to the guys watching, and we purposely kept three of these little creaks through there so you'd feel like you were from her perspective. Well, it was covered by, all this loud explosions and I don't know if explosions, but just this low end coming from somewhere. And I was like, gosh, we spent all this time. And there's a lot of energy in the professional world trying to come up with standards for dubbing stages and standards for, what the noise floors are and what the levels are and what the EQ curves are. And I think all that's a big waste of time if they can't get the exhibitors to make the investment to really try and isolate, sound isolate their rooms. You know, before you had multiplex, you didn't have this problem.
Right.
And since the advent of multiplexes, I don't think there's one person listening to this show or, you know, been to a movie in the last 10 years that hasn't heard that and said, what's that? Is that in the track? Did they mean
right.
that?
Is that in the track? Oh, you know? Man. As you say, no, you didn't mean it. After all that work you went into that went into it, that you spent many hours, as you say, to have it ruined by that must be very frustrating. Well, I certainly want to advocate. Sorry, go ahead.
I'm sorry. I was just going to say, it's still great going to movie theaters. It's still great experiencing movies. And, you know, hopefully in the next tranche of theaters that are being designed and built, they'll take that into account because it's still, you know, one of the best entertainment things in the world. I love movies. Movies are great.
Yeah. Yep, they sure are, and that's why I'm in this business, and that's why you're in this business as well.
Yes, I am.
Well, thank you so much. I want to thank Lon Bender, my guest geek for this week, for a fascinating hour of conversation about sound in the movies. You can find out more about him at his company's website, Sound Deluxe. That's SoundDelux.com for much more about what he does. And I noticed some people in the chat room also looking you up on IMDb and quite an impressive credit list. So thanks so much for being with us.
It's a real pleasure. And thank you, everybody, for interest in sound. It's a great world.
You bet. I couldn't agree more. My online home, of course, is hometheater.com. You can email me at scott@twit.tv. Particularly if you have any guests in mind that you think would be interesting on the show, please let me know. And you can follow me on Twitter at htgeekscott. Next week, my guest geek is scheduled to be Steve Guttenberg, a contributor to hometheater.com and Home Theater Magazine, and the author of the Audiophiliac blog on CNET, who is going to be talking about why audio measurements don't matter. A very controversial subject, so I hope you will tune in then. Until then, geek out.